Hey, good evening, Truth Seekers. Mike Malloy here. It is Friday, isn't it? Huh? We have, or I have been, I hate the editorial we, or the royal we. I've been out here in San Francisco at the Green 960 Studios for the past 3 days, and appreciate the fine assistance in getting this program together for the past couple of days from everybody here at Green 960. So thanks a lot, folks. Now, if you can just tell your program director to take the show live. Well, they do the third hour. That may change eventually, I guess. We had a great time today hanging out with Dave from San Francisco and Mike, who drives a cab. And between the two of them, we're all over the city. Mission District and what's the big park? The Golden Gate Park? Golden Gate Park. Mission District. The Haight-Ashbury neighborhood. Jesus, has that changed? Last time I was in Haight-Ashbury was about 25 years ago, 28 years ago. It's all rich people there now. Can't believe it. What happened to the hippies? What happened to the, you know, people walking down the street selling drugs? We did sign a petition to legalize marijuana. Ooh, big deal. Anyway, I love San Francisco. I really do. It's been a great stay out here. And the gig we did Wednesday night at Yoshi's was a lot of fun, too. So, thanks to everybody who made the show and the trip an enjoyable time. And I am ready to go home. The phone number here, and we're going to take calls a little bit earlier tonight than we normally do. The phone number is 877-996-2556. 877-996-2556. So if you have something on your mind that we've been talking about this week or not, give us a call, 877-996-2556. This, you know, the drug laws in this country are pretty much crazy anyway. They go back to the 70s, to the Rockefeller drug laws in New York, and then to acts of Congress that were overtly racist to begin with. But aside from the racism, the drug laws were absolutely insane. Just absolutely insane. And don't misunderstand, I mean, people that manufacture this horrible goddamn crank or whatever it is in their kitchens, Sarah Palin's daughter's almost mother-in-law, I think those people ought to be just explained to them very, very, very slowly with small, short sentences what they are doing. They are making poison. They're using industrial solvents to make stuff that people are going to smoke, and then they ought to be spanked soundly and put on a desert island for about 10 years. But the other stuff, I mean, especially marijuana laws, it's crazy. Just crazy. And it's gotten so crazy with the drug laws that here's a story. Yeah, I saw this today. I thought, no, that can't be. I had to read it a couple of times. It's from Terre Haute, Indiana. A woman there named Sally Harpold bought cold medicine for her family back in March. And she never dreamed that 4 months later, in July, she would end up in handcuffs. Now, here we are in October, she's trying to clear her name of criminal charges. And she's speaking out in hopes that a law will change so others won't endure the same embarrassment she still is facing. Now, this woman is a grandmother of triplets. She went to the drugstore. She bought a box of Zyrtec D cold medicine for her husband at a Rockville, Indiana or Maryland pharmacy. I don't know. Less than 7 days later, she bought a box of Mucinex D cold medicine for her adult daughter at another pharmacy. And in making those purchases, that had nothing to do with her grandchildren triplets. It had to do with her husband and her daughter. So she had bought one box of Zyrtec D cold medicine and one box of Mucinex D cold medicine. The D in those, of course, stands for decongestant. And in making that those two purchases, she thereby bought 3.6 grams of pseudoephedrine in a week's time. Oh! All the klaxons go off and the bells sound and lights start spinning. Those two purchases put her in violation of Indiana law 35-48-4-14.7, which restricts the sale of ephedrine and pseudoephedrine, or PSC, products to no more than 3.0 grams. This woman bought 3.6 grams. Do you know what 6/10 of a gram looks like? Anyway, within a 7-day period, she brought 3.0 grams. When the police came knocking at the door of her Park County residence on July 30th, she was arrested on a county warrant for a Class C misdemeanor, which carries a sentence of up to 60 days in jail and up to a $500 fine. Boing, boing, boing. Vermilion County Prosecutor Nina Alexander is proud to be, quote, enforcing the law as it was written, end quote, by prosecuting this grandmother who bought two boxes of cold medication in less than a week. The prosecutor, Nina Alexander, admits she knows grandma had no intention of making meth with the medicine, but that's beside the point. The prosecutor says the public has the responsibility to know that what is legal and what is not, and ignorance of the law is no excuse, and you all can kiss my ass if you don't like it. I'm the prosecutor. Get out of my face. I added the last part. The sheriff got his chance to show off, too, to show off a rock-solid understanding of cause and effect, too. He said, quote, I feel for her, but if she could go to one of the area hospitals and see a baby born to a meth-addicted mother. Lesson, the best way to prevent meth-addicted babies is to arrest grandmothers who buy cold medication for a couple of adults in their family. Son of a bitch, where do we live? This is in Indiana, the home of the Klan.
Well, if she's buying Mucinex and Zyrtec, obviously the woman's running a home crack lab.
It's just insane. And then for the prosecutor and the sheriff to adopt that attitude. Nina Alexander, the county Vermilion County prosecutor. Public has the responsibility to know what's legal and what isn't. I'll bet you there's not one person outside of maybe law enforcement, and not even them, in this whole county that knows that if you buy 3.6 grams of pseudoephedrine in cough medicine or cold medicine over a 7-day period, your ass is going to go to jail. I can't take this. That story just, you see those every once in a while, right? Somebody ought to get a petition on the streets in Indiana that to make cold medication legal the way they're trying to make marijuana legal here, right? You ever heard of Steve Schmidt? He's the former campaign manager for John McCain. He was talking with CNN's John King, and he said that he's warning that if Sarah Palin could lead to a what he calls a catastrophic election result for the Republican Party in 2012, if she gets the party's presidential nomination. Oh, don't worry. I hope she does. Oh, God. I just hope it's almost enough to make me pray again. You know, I'm ready to give up atheism. If they'll just, yes, God, let her be the Republican Party nominee, please. Steve Schmidt said, quote, I think she has talents. But my honest view is that she would not be a winning candidate for the Republican Party in 2012. And in fact, were she the nominee, we could have a catastrophic election result. Oh, really? God. Schmidt went on to say, I don't think it's inconceivable that she could be the Republican nominee for President of the United States. I do think it's fairly inconceivable that she could be elected President of the United States, but she could be the Republican nominee. Wouldn't that be wonderful? Wouldn't you love that? I mean, you, a rational, reasonable person, you're not one of these screwball conservatives. You're not a completely effed up Republican. You're just a normal person. Wouldn't it be wonderful to see Sarah Palin as the Republican Party nominee? One can hope, right? We'll be back. I'm Mike Malloy. Portion of the Mike Malloy Show is brought to you by It's Up to Us Alone, featuring Ed Asner. Go to usalone.com for information on where to hear the debut of this dramatic new radio play in your area. 21 past the hour. You want to do some calls? Okay, let's do some calls. Harold is in Oakland. Hey, Harold.
Yes, Mike. Welcome to Oakland.
Thank you, but I'm in San Francisco.
Well, I'm sorry about that. I'm an old guy, and I sometimes get a little forgetful.
that's all right.
Well, I really enjoy your format.
Yeah.
You're one of the few liberal talk show hosts that's not afraid to show the public that you have balls. And that's one of the things. I'm a lone, compassionate conservative crying out here in the Oakland wilderness. And while I appreciate that you have guts, I have some fundamental disagreements with you that you feel that us Republicans are racists, for instance. And I hire the colored.
I'm just kind of laughing. Go ahead, Harold. You hire the colored. That's good. Yeah, yeah.
And I you know, Bush and Cheney raised the ire of many Americans by.
What do you hire the colored to do?
I'm a contractor.
You're a contractor?
Correct.
Oh, do you hire like people who speak Spanish?
I will do that as well. I like to give everyone a chance, regardless of what their.
Well, do you ask them if they are legal have legal documents or?
If they have a security Social Security card, that's sufficient.
Well, it's not really, and you know it's not, Harold. You know that a Social Security card is a joke, so you don't check any further than whether or not they have a Social Security card, right?
I like to pay everyone a good wage.
Well, do you support immigration reform?
Oh, yes, I do. I think.
But Harold, that'll put you out of business.
Well, hello.
Hello.
Yes, well, I
see, this is the point I'm trying to make here. This is where I really think that you conservatives are just crazier than a rabid rat. I mean, you really are, because on the one hand, you will hire people that can't provide the documentation required by law. And when you hire them, it's kind of a wink, wink, nudge, nudge. You know damn good and well that you're probably hiring somebody that's in the country illegally. Now, I don't happen to have a problem with that, but I'm not a conservative. I would open my jugular vein before I would become a conservative. But you guys are the ones who always are screaming about these lousy goddamn immigrants. You know, these lousy immigrants. You know, we got to do something. Well, what is it that you want to do? Why don't you stop being a hypocrite? If you're going to be a conservative. And every conservative agrees that, you know, we got to stop this illegal immigration because, you know, these people come up here and have babies and go in the hospital and we have to pay for it. Well, let's have national health care. No, can't do that. Well, let's have some kind of a way of keeping track of people who come to the country. No, can't do that because then I'd have to, you know, pay better wages. You see, As far as I'm concerned, Republicans are wacko. And conservatives, well, Republicans are just off the chart in stupidity and wackiness. Conservatives are just plain wacko. Anyway, thanks, Harold. I appreciate you checking in, but, you know, I just not in the mood to listen to a bunch of hypocritical nonsense tonight. All right? Thank you. Corny?
Hello?
What's your name?
I'm Corgi.
Corgi?
No, Courtney. C-O-U-R-T-N-E-Y. Courtney.
Corgany. That's an interesting name. What is that?
Courtney's a guy.
Oh, Jesus. I mean, what is it? French? Is it Italian? Is it Swahili? What is it?
No, it's an English name. I'm from the islands. In the islands, guy get named Courtney. In America, girl get named. So a lot of time I'm mistaken for a woman.
Oh, okay. Well, you're calling.
It's a female name in America, yeah.
You're calling from Atlanta. Welcome to the program, Courtney.
Yeah, I just want to tell you, I listen to you every night.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
I follow you from here, America, all over. Anywhere you at, I try to find you.
Well, thank you, because I always used to get fired because I was too much of a liberal or a leftist, which is kind of a joke because I'm about as left as, I don't know. Whatever. But I'm glad you keep following me. I can't be fired now because I own my own company, so.
Yeah, I love that. And the reason why I called you, I've always listened to you and I always want to talk to you because I agree with, maybe 1% of the time I never agree with you. So I'm all, like 99% of the time I'm always with you. So you crack me up every night I'm listening to you. You're always on point. And what I like about you, you don't mesh your words. You just say it as it is. You know, mainstream media and the rest of them, they're trying to play nice. The guys on the other side, they're mean. You understand? They're very mean. They're not afraid to call the people on the left a liar. They say Clinton was a liar. They say Obama is a liar. The biggest liar is Bush, and nobody ever calls him a liar.
Mm-hmm.
And we always try to play nice, like we try to be politically correct. And I never get it, so I appreciate you. I love you. You know, I'm from Atlanta.
Uh-huh.
You know, I'm in Georgia just like you, and you know, I really wanted to touch on the healthcare subject a little bit because I don't understand these people that say they're supposed to be Democrats, but might as well they say they're Republicans.
I know.
You understand? They have no interest in what's good for the poor people of this country.
That's true.
You understand? That,
yeah, I do.
Why not they give up their health insurance? The one they have, they can make choice. Why don't give us the same choice?
That's
we
it. That,
have the same privilege as they
that,
do.
That's very true. Courtney, thanks. I got a boogie. Thank you. I appreciate your call. Take care. Drive safely. About 25 before the hour. This is the Molloy program. Cat Mary in Memphis helps me out a little bit here. Republicans are like Slinkies. Slinkies. Remember those toys? Slinkies. She writes, they're worthless for anything useful, but they do bring a smile to your lips when you push them down the stairs. Yeah, they do. Molloy advocates murdering conservatives on his program on, what's the day today? Is this the second? Yeah, okay. We have a report here from our economic affairs correspondent, Prairie 2, who writes, 0.3% of the U.S. adult population is the amount of people that have stopped participating in the official workforce and are not counted in the unemployment numbers. Just in September, that's 571,000 people. This number's from the Labor Department. And who knows if it's really big enough. Nearly a million more people applied for Social Security benefits in the past year than was expected. 263,000 jobs were officially lost in September, but that doesn't really tell the story. For every job that comes available, there are officially six people who want it. The media keep repeating the chant that this will somehow turn around next year, as if by magic. It's just a cycle, you know. No mention of the millions of jobs sent out of the country and how thousands more leave every week. Fewer and fewer people are working to provide support for the rest of the economy. Less and less is produced here, and our credit card with China gets closer and closer to where Beijing will not accept it anymore. The unpleasant truth is that even if enough stimulus money was pumped into the system to inflate the so-called service economy, it would only make the trade deficit worse and hasten total collapse of the dollar. We will have a new way of doing things in America. The question is, who will be deciding what that will look like? Will it be the masters of the universe that are currently running the plutonomy? That's the economy for the plutocracy. They represent 1% of the population, and they own more than the bottom 90% combined. They have half of the income, and life is good. We've seen this before. It was called the Roaring Twenties. Meanwhile, here in 1933, three more banks failed today. Go to his website, prairie2.com. China is cruising along, aren't they? Did you see they're having their, what is it, the 60th? No, 50th? Yeah, 50th celebration of the revolution. 1959, 50th anniversary of that revolution. And have you watched some of the video? Whoa, you talk about precision. And everybody participating in this, they all seem to be in great health. They all seem to be lean and trim and fit. China has emerged from whatever ripple effect hit their country of this global economic meltdown. They're back producing stuff. I don't know who in the hell is going to buy it, but, well, the rest of the world, not here. A lot of it's going to be bought in South America, a lot of it in the rest of Asia, Europe, Russia. The Russians love the toys made in China. Canadians will buy it, but here in the United States, well. So I look at those pictures of the Chinese, and they just seem supremely confident. And, you can understand why, right? I remember back in the 80s when there was all this talk about Japan Incorporated. Remember that? Where all of a sudden the Japanese were flush with money and they bought Rockefeller Center and they tried to buy the Empire State Building. They were buying everything. And everybody's going, oh my God. And the Japanese tourists were showing up and they were just dressed fit to kill and they had all this wonderful camera equipment and shop girls, so-called, could take trips around the world, and salarymen could take their families and put them on a 747 and go to Europe or go to California. Remember all that? And then it disappeared. And then China had a decade of stagflation, Japan had a decade of stagflation, whatever you want to call it. They have a very unusual phenomenon in Japan right now. It's called unemployment. The numbers are rising. But China, of course, China has been producing everything. And thanks to globalization, you know, I didn't realize Bill Clinton and George Herbert Walker Bush were of Chinese descent. Obviously, they must be, because they made sure with NAFTA that everything would eventually, all the manufacturing base in this country eventually would go to that country. You getting nervous yet? I remember back several months ago when I started reading Prairie 2's emails on the air, and I would laugh, hey, buy canned goods. Hey, Prairie 2 always says buy canned goods. Prairie 2, you're just, I don't know, you're kind of a, the sky is falling, the sky is falling. You know what I'm doing now? buying canned goods. Oh, my God. So, do you think we'll get through this? Paul Krugman today. Was it today at the New York Times? He writes about how, you know, stocks are up. Well, they were up. Ben Bernanke says the recession is over. And Krugman writes, I sense a growing willingness among movers and shakers to declare mission accomplished when it comes to fighting the slump. He says, it's time, I keep hearing, to shift our focus from economic stimulus to the budget deficit. No, it isn't. And the complacency, Krugman writes, now settling in over the state of the economy is both foolish and dangerous. Yes, the Federal Reserve and the Obama administration have, quote, pulled us back from the brink. But while not having another depression is a good thing, all indications are that unless the government does much more than is currently planned to help the economy recover, the job market, a market in which there are currently six times as many people seeking work as there are jobs on offer, the job market will remain terrible for years to come. Indeed, the administration's own economic projection is that the unemployment rate, which was below 5% just 2 years ago, will average 9.8% in 2010, 8.6% in 2011, 7.7% in 2012, and so on and so on. And blah, blah, blah. He goes on about the human cost, what's going to happen here. And see, this is where Barack Obama has been, to me, has been an abject disappointment. We need a Works Project Administration or something similar. The American worker is not being put to work. The numbers keep getting worse and worse, and the numbers are always jiggered. You know we are. It doesn't make any difference if it's a Democratic or a Republican administration. They lie. They all lie about this stuff. And, you know, I'm not blaming Obama for the situation, but I do kind of hold him accountable for not providing a solution. Because the solution, I think, is clear to any Democratic socialist or to anyone who wants to see the country turn back from the direction we're heading, and that is to provide. I mean, the country is in desperate shape. Think of all the people in construction, whether it's roads, bridges, dams, schools, national parks, the roadways. I mean, everything is falling apart in the country. Because we spent 20 years of not really giving a tinker's damn about what was going on. Just give me the money. Let me go buy new shiny things. Oh, look. Mine's bigger than yours. Yeah, but mine's faster than yours. Yeah, but mine has more dials. And look where we are. So, seriously, the only way to get out of this, I think, is to focus, to get our heads either out of the clouds or out of our own rear ends, wherever our heads happen to be, and take a look at what has to be done. And we have to get our people back to work. We have to. We have to. And that doesn't mean these training programs where you take somebody who has put 35 years in at a General Motors plant someplace. They're only 55 years old, and all of a sudden, they don't have a job. They're 55, for Christ's sake. There's no unemployment comp for them anymore because they've run through it. What's left? And you tell this man or this woman, okay, we're going to retrain you. To do what? You know, I was a drop forge operator. What are you going to retrain me to do? For 20 years, I ran a drop forge. What are you going to train me to do?
We're going to retrain you to... We're going to retrain you to, let me see, to do, you're going to be a nurse's aide.
What?
Yes, we're going to teach you how to take blood pressure readings and pulses and temperatures.
And how much does that pay?
$6.50 an hour.
Jesus Christ, when I worked at General Motors, I was making $27.50 an hour.
Well, you're going to have to dial it back a bit. Next.
What are we going to do? Retrain a worker who was a machinist or an equipment operator or worked in an assembly line making stuff, and now what's this worker going to do? What is he being retrained for?
Well, I'm going to be a computer specialist.
Doing what?
I don't know. It just, that's what they told me. Meantime, I don't have money to pay my mortgage. We'll be back after the break. It is 10 before the hour. This is the Malloy program. Yeah, it was China's 60th. Sorry about that. I said 50th. It's 1949, not 1959. So thanks to the, I don't know, about 70 people who emailed me to correct that. But no, seriously, thank you. I don't know what I was thinking about. Back to your calls. Catherine is in Tucson. Hey, Catherine.
Hey, I was just waiting to get on the podcast contest.
Oh, not tonight.
Do you have that tonight?
No, I'm in San Francisco, and we have all that in Atlanta. And
sorry.
So maybe we'll do it Monday night when we're back in Atlanta. We'll probably do it twice next week, Monday night and Friday night. That's the only reason.
Well, I lost last week, Catherine in Tucson.
Oh yeah,
Following you since the Air America days. And you know, the ironic thing is that I'm studying to be a history teacher, and I got the question about the Bushes wrong.
Oh, yeah?
And the reason I got it wrong is because they are so absolutely irrelevant to my life. So I just didn't pay attention.
Right. Well, I can certainly understand that. Yeah.
Thank you. All right. I look forward to talking to you Monday.
Okay. All right. You have a nice weekend, Catherine. Charlie is in Potomac, Maryland. Hey, Charlie.
Hey, Mike, I enjoy your show. I do a lot of night driving, and I wanted to talk about the Palestinian-Israeli situation.
Sure. Yeah.
I've traveled the Middle East a lot, Tel Aviv. My father's from Ramallah, which is a Christian city over there.
Uh-huh.
And I think that the perspective of this of the United States is not handling everything even-handedly as far as the way the...
You think?
Yeah, and all the Middle East countries over the years just don't trust this country. To me, the Israelis want PEICA, which is piece of land, not the other piece. I've seen many Palestinians that have been there 6-7 generations that have had their land taken, mm-hmm. their olive groves taken, their houses demolished, and they expect them not to do anything about it. The Israelis launder everything. I call them professional distractors. I've been to Jerusalem. The Israelis have a place called the Russian Compound where they arrest Palestinians for traffic violations. They don't have lawyers. And the Russian Compound is used for torturing potential terrorists. And they use batteries. I've talked to Palestinians that were burnt with cigarettes. They distract. If you bring anything up that they may have done, including Lebanon, which I went there, and I saw what their phosphorus bombs. I'm a Vietnam veteran, by the way. I flew helicopters over there, and I saw the atrocities that imperialistic Americans
right.
have done. I love this country. I am an American. But if Sarah Palin had gotten elected, I would have moved out of the country because we'd be in war with Iran.
Mm-hmm.
There's no question Obama's making mistakes. But I believe you get more bees with honey than vinegar to try to negotiate, to go over there and build wells and build schools and build infrastructure and try to build that type of relation. But the Israeli conflict needs to be resolved. And in Israel, I would say 70% of the Israelis want two states, just like maybe we don't want to be in Iraq. But, you know, the higher-ups and whoever are causing these things to happen. And I think if we ever can settle the Middle East situation to state, we have to deal with what's going on today. We can't go back, you know, 70 years or so. But, you know, if they can work this thing out, I think we'll be a far better place. And when Rubin was working with Carter, I thought maybe, you know, when I was in Jerusalem, they opened the bridge to Jordan.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, you know, there'd be money made for everybody, and then maybe things would be okay. But, of course, an Israeli killed him. But they have committed tremendous atrocities against the Palestinian people. But even National Geographic's 2009 in June, there's 10 pages on Christian Palestinians that had their groves and their houses taken. So we sent a few rockets over there, which I agree, but that's all they have, and it killed a couple of people. But they go to Lebanon, who the people have nothing to do with Israel, and kill thousands of them, and we never talk about the wounded. And it's like they have an excuse for everything, including bombing the UN building with civilians in it. You know, I do want peace. I don't like war. But I love your show. You're so honest, and I think there's just a few of you around. If it could be like a virus and catch on to people and try to correct things.
Mm. Well, that's kind of you to say. Charlie, thanks. Thanks for the comments. I certainly agree with in spirit with what you said. As long as the Jews really believe that God gave them that land, why relinquish it? To relinquish it or to not claim it would be in defiance of God. And Israel was set up as a Jewish state, not as a democracy, not as a democratic republic, but as a theocratic state, much like the Islamic Republic of Iran. But the United States, you see, we did the same thing. We had God telling us, it was called Manifest Destiny 250 years ago. You know, God sent us over here to murder and annihilate the people who were already here. Because God wanted white Europeans to take over this continent, and therefore God had to be obeyed. It was called Manifest Destiny, and we did a pretty good job. You know, we put together a republic based on slavery and genocide, and man, it went great for a while. The Israelis, we've talked about this a million times. The Jews that came from Brooklyn and Kiev and Buenos Aires and Johannesburg, and you know, they went to Israel because God had given them the land and started killing and eliminating the Palestinians. And you know, what are you going to do when God has told you to do something? What are you going to do? Say no? We'll be back after the break. This is the Malloy Show. I'm Mike Malloy, coming to you from Green 960 studio in San Francisco. We will be back on home turf on Monday night. Thanks to everybody at Green 960 for providing the facility so we could do the show. I've gotten several emails here about the guy who called in from, where was it, Oakland, who said he was in the construction business, and he hired the colored. George writes, please tell me that was a put on. I know the Republicans are not real bright, but colored? What a moron. And there's more here. Thanks, George. No, I don't know if it was a put on or not. I don't think so. The guy sounded about the right age to refer to our dusky brethren as colored. Aside from that, a little slice of ingrown racism. That's the kind of racism that'll never come out. You just kind of ignore that, I guess, until they pick up a rope, right? Then you can't ignore it. But the part of his call that was very intriguing to me was the duplicity that most Republicans have where it concerns cheap labor. You know?
Well, yeah, I hire Mexicans.
Well, do they have proper documentation that you guys are always yelling about?
Well, yeah, they got a Social Security card. I always check.
A, no, you don't. But B, so what? You know, you want a Social Security card? I can get you 20 of them. In the, let's see, what time is it? Here on the West Coast, it's 7:07. I can have 20 Social Security cards in your hand within 10 minutes. Come on, get real. But the that is so typically Republican. Remember, to a real capitalist, real conservative, real Republican, whatever that means anymore, I have no idea. They're crazy. They're all insane. They're maddeningly insane. But to a real capitalist, the best kind of labor is free labor. That's why slavery was just, you know, so American. That's why it's in the Bible. You know, the Bible tells slaves, do what your master tells you and shut up. So, the people that believe in the inerrancy of the Bible don't like the fact that the coloreds are not working the fields anymore for free. They're not slaves anymore because the Bible says they're supposed to, you know. Oh, man. It's getting crazy. Thank goodness it's Friday, right? Alan is in Oklahoma City. Hello, Alan.
Hey, Mike, how's it going?
Sliding right along, pal.
I just wanted to say a few things about your thoughts on what's happening to the middle class. We're witnessing the destruction of it. I believe that you're right about the losing of the manufacturing jobs and being shipped out to other countries. And in replace of those manufacturing jobs, what did we get? Wall Street. What does Wall Street produce for us? Nothing.
Nothing.
People with money, more money.
Well, they Wall Street produces debt, and then the debt is traded back and forth among the high rollers, and all of a sudden the debt takes on value to these people in the same way a house or a car or a widget would take on value back in the long ago olden days when we actually built or made things here. So this debt, and not only do they trade it back and forth amongst themselves, but they take out insurance policies. Well, the debt is, let's take an insurance policy, the debt is going to pay off. And then they bet against the insurance policy, and then they add another one. I mean, it's just stacking insanity on insanity, but the problem is they all make money, and then when the house of cards collapses, you and I go on the hook to bail these sons of bitches out. I am so sick of it. I am ready to become a complete, total communist. Hello?
I'm still here with you. Isn't that what they call a derivative, or can someone...
I don't even know. I think that's derivatives or whatever the hell they're called. They have initials. They have... It's terminology that most of us don't understand. A lot of the people trading these things don't understand. They just know they get a check. They sell and buy and sell and laugh their asses off. They go, oh, man, I made another $10 million. Yeah, but what about the economic base, the manufacturing base of the United States? It's gone. Oh, well, that's not my problem. You know, give me some more derivatives.
Have you seen Michael Moore's new movie?
I haven't. When I left Atlanta last week, it hadn't opened there yet. But I will go see it for sure.
Yeah, I'm thinking about seeing it tonight with some buddies. I'm 20 years old, and not too many people around my age care a lot about politics, but I think it's important, you know. I used to not care, but I realize everything that's going around me, and if somebody doesn't do something, you know, I might not have a future in this country, you know.
What, you're 20?
Yeah.
What do you do? Do you work? Are you in school?
I work, and I'm in school. Yeah, I do both.
And are you still on your own? You're not married or have kids or anything?
No, I'm not married. I live with my parents. My job is I go to these oil leases, and I make sure they're environmentally compliant mm-hmm. so they don't get fined by the EPA. I mean, it pays the bills. I make good money every now and then. You know, it's depending on the price of oil, so
right.
I mean, it's decent right now. But school, you know, go to school, try and get a degree.
What's your opinion on what has happened? I mean, it's most of this has happened in your lifetime. I realize you weren't thinking about this when you were two.
Yeah.
But this stuff has happened since the mid '80s. So what do you think? I mean, what's your take on the whole the overview? What's your opinion?
Well, what's interesting is that I wasn't around for Reagan, and when Clinton was around, I was a kid, and around the time when Bush was around, I was in middle school and high school. And I had a basic understanding of what was going on, you know, about the war and the weapons of mass destruction.
Right.
And I was like, even in high school, I was like, well, we never found them. You know, what are we still doing there? And as I get older, you learn more about, you know, how this country works and how the economy works. And even before I began to choose, you know, what I believe in politically, you begin to find out, like, who, you know, which party or even which ideology benefits who,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Right.
And how I believe conservatism is an ideology of greed,
mm-hmm.
an ideology of that's against the working class, it's against the people, that it's, I believe that it benefits the rich.
Right.
You know? I can't remember the last time a Republican did something that to actually help the people, you know.
Yeah, it's very rare when that does happen. How are you planning your life, or do you pretty much take it as it comes, like a month at a time, a year at a time? Do you make long range plans at your age?
I mean, it's basically to graduate college with no debt. I mean, I'm 2 years in and I don't owe a dime on my college,
that's
my
good.
College bill, which is really rare, you know.
Sure.
But I mean, I don't know, you know. I'm not declared a major yet. You know, the subject's really interesting to me.
Mm-hmm.
Major in political science, you know, and really getting in depth view on how our politics works. And, you know, I would be very interested in getting involved in it, whether it's, what's it called? Advising or actually being in a political position.
Mm-hmm. Well, good luck to you, Alan. It sounds like you've got a pretty clear view of a pretty clear political view of what has happened in this country. I've got and Alan, thanks. I appreciate what you had to say. I've got kids. I have one child younger than you, but all my other kids are older than you, and I talk to them about, you know, what is your plan? And most of them are pretty good. I have my 30-year-old son is back in school, as is his wife. She's going to be a lawyer. She's in law school. He's in nursing school. He had spent a lot of time as a firefighter and an EMT, and then decided to, you know, if you could live on $18,000 a year, continue to be a firefighter. If you can't live on that, then you've got to do something else. And their outlook, my kids' outlook is the outlooks are worried, you know, for the most part. And then I think about my 5-year-old. Jesus God. So, you know, the idea of if it comes to the point where people have to leave this country, young people have to leave this country in order to make a living, in order to exist, well, yeah, I guess you'd have to do that. We'll be back after the break. I'm Mike Malloy. 21 past the hour. Marlene in Miami writes in, Mike, just heard you talk about a jobs program for America like Roosevelt's WPA or the CCC or whatever. What we need in this country is a high-speed rail system. So instead of investing in Iraq and Afghanistan, how about investing in America, building a modern rail system? And those jobs can't be outsourced. What are we waiting for? Marlene in Miami. I don't know. Leadership? I don't know what we're waiting for. I have no idea. A high-speed rail system? My God, that would put hundreds of thousands of people to work for what? Just like the interstate highway system back in the 50s when it was begun by Eisenhower. It put hundreds of thousands of people to work. Massive, the most massive construction job, I think I've got this right, in the history of the human race. The interstate highway system. Was it ultimately bad for America because, we all got cars and trucks and polluted the atmosphere? Yes, everything is bad for us. I mean, you know, let's be real. Anything that we do, unless we're, you know, living in the forest, eating berries and bark and stuff, and, building very small fires, and, anything beyond that is bad for us. I understand that. I really do. Of course, population control would have been cool. But I digress. So, a huge jobs program like a rail system, an electric, the magnetic rail system, like so many advanced countries, not like us. We're rapidly becoming a third world country. And of course, when you have an empire collapsing, that's when it becomes the most dangerous to everybody else on the planet and dangerous internally. Because the people that don't want it to collapse, you know, the crazy people, get even more and more vicious, more right-wing, more neo-Nazi-like. So these are precarious times. They really are. We may come out of this. We may not. And if we don't, well, you know, goodbye and thanks for all the fish. That's it's easy to understand, right? Oh, the number here, if you want to call in, 877-996-2556. 877-996-2556. Got one open line. John is in Jonesville, Georgia. Hey, John.
Hey, Mike. It's good to talk to you, sir. I've listened a long time. I've never called, though, but I listen to you every night.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
I'm very frustrated as you are. I have a six-year-old. Me and my wife had him later in life, and I'm really worried about his future in this country. I have two senators in Arkansas, Blanche Lincoln and Mark Pryor.
Right.
They're both Democrats, but they're not Democrats.
No, they're not.
If you look at the voting record, they voted for everything Beavis Bush wanted. But they will not give us any type of health insurance.
Mm-hmm.
They don't believe in that. In fact, I wrote letters to them. I received emails back from them saying, no, they don't believe it's in the country's best interest to offer any type of option plan, anything.
Mm.
So I guess they support the big insurance company.
Sure.
But I'm so frustrated with it. You know, everywhere I go in, it's because I'm a truck driver, and I used to run the roads one into the other. Now I just go between Memphis and Nashville.
Uh-huh.
But every little town across this country, the only stations you can get is probably Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity and them hordes.
Right.
That's all you can listen to.
That's
right. And
they
brainwash this country is what they've done.
That's right.
It's just made me sick. It really is, and I'm afraid for my son's future, even our future at this point.
Well, I share that fear, John, and I don't know. I've said before, if you believe in something, you got to fight for it. But when you fight metaphorically for years and nothing happens, then you think, well, the only alternative is to fight physically for it, and then you start to weigh the odds of that. The final option is to say, to hell with this. I'm just going to go live someplace else. I don't need to do this. I don't need to be here. I don't need to put up with this decline. I don't need to listen to the garbage. I don't need to see people elected one after another who promise stuff and never deliver. You get to a point, don't you, where you just get so damn tired of it. You say, okay, you know, uncle, you guys win. I'm out of here. Goodbye. I'm going, you know? You understand what I'm saying with that?
Oh, yes, 100%. You know, and your last caller, the young man that called in, all he has to do is do a little research on the Republican Party, because all they are is haters. And he will find that out by just doing his research, just what they are.
Yeah.
And they always have been.
That's true. That's true. All right, man.
Anyway,
listen, drive safe. I appreciate you checking in, Randy, and thanks for being out there. Thanks for listening, okay?
Take care, sir.
All right, you too. Yeah, you know, at what point do you say, I'm not gonna take up a gun and shoot people. I'm not gonna try to have a rifle, my damn deer rifle or something up at, a 30 caliber rifle, or a 9mm handgun. I'm not gonna have that up against some well outfitted private army who's been told to go out and get the guns. And not told by Obama, told by corporate America.
It's time to bring this goddamn experiment to an end.
You know, I don't want to be around for that. Do you? We'll be right back. Before the hour, this is the Malloy program. David Brooks, op-ed columnist in the New York Times, had a piece today that I just found very interesting. I want to share it with you. All right, this is David Brooks. He says, "Let's take a trip back into history—not ancient history, recent history. It's the winter of 2007." The presidential primaries are approaching. The talk jocks like Limbaugh, Beck, Hannity, and the rest are over the moon about Fred Thompson. They're weak at the knees at the thought of Mitt Romney. Meanwhile, they're hurling torrents of abuse at the unreliable deviationists John McCain and Mike Huckabee. Yet somehow, despite the fervor of the great microphone giants, the Fred Thompson campaign flops like a fish. Despite the schoolgirl delight from the radio studios, the Romney campaign underperforms. Meanwhile, Huckabee surges. Limbaugh attacks him. But social conservatives flock. Along comes New Hampshire, and McCain wins. Republican voters have not heeded their masters in the media. Before long, South Carolina looms as the crucial point of the race. The contest is effectively between Romney and McCain. The talk jocks are now in spittle-flecked furor. Day after day, whole programs are dedicated to hurling abuse at McCain and everybody ever associated with him. The jocks are threatening to unleash their angry millions. Yet the imaginary armies do not materialize. McCain wins the South Carolina primary and goes on to win the nomination. The talk jocks can't even deliver the conservative voters who show up at Republican primaries. They can't even deliver South Carolina. So what's the theme of our history lesson? It's a story of remarkable volume and utter weakness. It is the story of media mavens who claim to represent a hidden majority, but who in fact represent a mere niche, even in the Republican Party. It's a story as old as the Wizard of Oz, of grand illusions and small men behind the curtain. But of course, we shouldn't be surprised by this story. Over the past few years, the talk jocks have demonstrated their real-world weakness time and again. Back in 2006, they threatened to build a new majority of anti-immigration fervor. Republicans like J.D. Hayworth and Randy Graff, both of Arizona, built their House election campaigns under that banner. These two didn't march to glory. Both lost their campaigns. In 2008, after McCain had won the nomination, Limbaugh turned his attention to the Democratic race. He commanded his followers to vote in the Democratic primaries for Hillary Clinton because, quote, "We need Barack Obama bloodied up politically," end quote. Todd Donovan of Western Washington University has looked at data from the 38 states and could find no strong evidence that significant numbers of people actually did what Limbaugh commanded. Rush blared the trumpets, but few of his ditto heads advanced. Over the years, I've asked many politicians what happens when Limbaugh and his colleagues attack. The story is always the same. Hundreds of calls come in. The receptionists are miserable, but the numbers back home do not move. There is no effect on the favorability rating or the reelection prospects. In the media world, he's a giant. In the real world, he's not. But this is not merely a story of weakness. It's a story of resilience. For no matter how often their hollowness is exposed, these talk jocks still reweave the myth of their own power. They still ride the airwaves claiming to speak for millions. They still confuse listeners with voters. And they are aided in this endeavor by their enablers. They are enabled by cynical Democrats who love the claim that Rush Limbaugh controls the GOP. They are enabled by lazy pundits who find it easier to argue with showmen than with people whose opinions are based on knowledge. They are enabled by the slightly educated snobs who believe that Glenn Beck really is the voice of middle America. So the myth returns. Just months after the election and the humiliation, everyone is again convinced that Limbaugh, Beck, Hannity, and the rest possess real power. And the saddest thing is that even Republican politicians come to believe it. They mistake media for reality. They preemptively surrender to armies that don't exist. They pay more attention to Russia's imaginary millions than to the real voters down the street. The Republican Party is unpopular because it's more interested in pleasing Russia's ghosts than actual people. The party is leaderless right now because nobody has the guts to step outside the rigid parameters enforced by the radio talk jocks and create a new party of identity. The party is losing because it has adopted a radio entertainer's niche-building strategy while abandoning the politician's coalition-building strategy. The rise of Beck and Hannity and Bill O'Reilly and the rest has correlated almost perfectly with the decline of the Republican Party. But it's not because the talk jocks have real power. It's because they have illusory power. Because Republicans hear the media mythology and fall for it every time. David Brooks is the kind of conservative that I could certainly have dinner with. So when I read this morning, sitting at a cafe in downtown San Francisco, out on the street in this beautiful weather, I'm reading this and watching the gorgeous girls go by here in San Francisco. And reading David Brooks' column, and it suddenly occurred to me, you know, you're part of the enablers, Malloy. You're one of the people he's talking about. Because you constantly harp on this illusory power of Hannity and Beck and Limbaugh and O'Reilly and the rest of these rat bastards. So I had my little moment this morning where I sat there all by myself at this outdoor table and got red in the face, blushed with embarrassment. Because, you know, David Brooks was writing directly to me, and what he was saying, hey, Malloy, stop it. These guys are goddamn clowns. Stop it. Stop. Look, you got a radio program? Stop spending any time at all talking about these jerks. And so I said back to him, oh, this conversation's going on in my head, you know, which shows you the condition I'm on, or I'm in. And I said to David, David, you know what? You're right. You're absolutely right. I feel like a real schmuck here. No more. No more talk about these screwballs. Hannity, Beck. So I just wanted to share that with you. Now, my caller, the truck driver, the guy who called a little while ago about, you know, all this crap that they've spilled into the airwaves, he's right about that. You know, the 24/7 blanketing of all this right-wing garbage. But it doesn't stir people to activism. It stirs people to fear. That's why the Republicans are just broken. They don't exist anymore. It's a party of cowards. It's a party of people who don't know which way to turn. So they turn towards Sarah Palin. Oh my God. So yeah, this 24/7 tidal wave of BS that comes from every single radio in America. coast to coast, border to border, every single day. Garbage, lies, distortions, untruths, half-truths, complete nonsense. And the bobbleheads, you know, it doesn't translate into legislative action. It doesn't translate into elective action. It just translates into fear, confusion, anxiety, doubt, uncertainty, racism, nastiness, bitchy attitudes. Well, these guys sit back and rake in the millions. So, if I do talk about these scum suckers again, please send me an email and say, Malloy, we thought you had an epiphany. You know, all this talk about Iran's nuclear forces and, you know, the potential for this and, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. And most of the rest of the world looks at us regarding this issue like the hypocrites that we are. Utter hypocrites. Not because we maintain a huge nuclear arsenal enough to split the planet, but because of our attitude about Israel's nukes, right? This is in the Washington Times now, today. Now, I say Washington Times because you have to consider the source, right? Didn't your mama tell you that? Always consider the source. Washington Times is a Mooney newspaper. It's right-wing. Every once in a while, like a stopped clock, though, they're correct. Stopped clock is correct twice a day, right? But it's under the headline of an exclusive. Obama agrees to keep Israel's nukes secret. And what it says, Obama has affirmed a four-decade-old secret understanding that has allowed Israel to keep a nuclear arsenal without opening it to international inspections, according to three officials familiar with the understanding. The officials, who spoke on condition they not be named because they were discussing private conversations, said Mr. Obama pledged to maintain the agreement when he first hosted Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu at the White House back in May. Under the understanding, the U.S. has not pressured Israel to disclose its nuclear weapons or to sign the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, which could require Israel to give up its estimated several hundred nuclear bombs. Now, there's more here, and I want to share it with you when we come back, because this is one of the reasons that U.S. foreign policy, and I don't care who's in charge, Democrat, Republican, Royalist, Whig, know-nothing, it doesn't make any difference. As long as we have this kind of a policy where it concerns Israel, we're going to have problems. We'll be right back. This portion of the Mike Malloy Show is brought to you by It's Up to Us Alone, featuring Ed Asner. Go to usalone.com for information on where to hear the debut of this dramatic new radio play in your area. All right, now before somebody starts emailing me, accusing me of being anti-Semitic and all the usual garbage that I get when I bring up this topic, let me just make the point again that as long as we have this duplicitous policy that we've had ever since the establishment of the State of Israel, where it concerns other people in the Middle East, we're going to have enemies that will keep us at war on some level. If the time ever comes when the United States deals with the so-called both sides in this issue of the Palestinian territories in the country of Israel, if we ever deal with that open-handedly, honestly, and assist in solving the situation, some of our troubles, a big chunk of our troubles would disappear. And in fact, so would the troubles for Israel. But after being acutely aware of this ever since the 1967 war, I guess that's when I first got my awareness about this horrific situation in the Middle East, I've come to the conclusion that there is no solution. It's not going to be solved because, like I said, when you're told that God told you to go to this country and take over, what are you going to do? Especially if you also have been told that you're God's chosen people. What are you going to do? Now, it's not just the Jews. The white Europeans who came here were told the same thing. You know, they were mostly of the Christian cult. They were told, go to the New World. It's yours. Manifest destiny. I want you to go there. I want you to establish my kingdom on earth. Kill everybody who's there. Just like Joshua was told before they went into the land of Canaan. Same thing. Go to the New World. Kill everybody. Bring your slaves. Get lots of slaves. Because, man, we're going to build this dynamic shining city on a hill. Yada, yada. Part of the problem is our policy where it concerns Israel's nuclear arsenals. Everybody on earth that's interested knows that Israel has nukes. But rather than just declare, yeah, okay, we got them. No. Don't want to do that. Let's keep everybody guessing. Who? Who's guessing? Now, the American public doesn't know squat about Israel's nuclear arsenal. Hell, the American public doesn't know squat about our nuclear arsenal. A lot of people think that because the Berlin Wall came down, all the nukes were destroyed. And you people that believe that are just dumber than dog droppings. But anyway, I digress. So back to the Washington Times. Under this understanding between Obama and Netanyahu, the U.S. has not and will not pressure Israel to disclose its nuclear weapons or to sign the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. I think there's only three countries that haven't signed that, right? Israel, Pakistan, and India. Is that right? And according to the Washington Times, quote, Israel has been nervous that Mr. Obama would not continue the 1969 understanding because of Obama's, strong support for nonproliferation and priority on preventing Iran from developing nuclear weapons. You see? The U.S. and five other world powers made progress during talks with Iran in Geneva on Thursday as Iran agreed in principle to transfer some potential bomb fuel out of the country. Yeah, to Russia, and to open a recently disclosed facility to international inspection. Now, supposedly that occurred yesterday. Remember, we said earlier that there was going to be this meeting, this 3+3 EG, whatever the hell it was, where China, Russia, U.S., France, Great Britain, and who else are going to sit down with an Iranian representative in Geneva, Switzerland, and try to work this out. So, Iran agreed in principle yesterday to transfer some of this potential bomb fuel, some of this enriched uranium that is a byproduct of what they say they're doing, using nuclear power, developing nuclear power to run their country. They don't want to use oil. They want to use nuclear power. Okay. Netanyahu let the news of the continued U.S.-Israeli accord slip last week in a remark that attracted little notice. He was asked by Israel's Channel 2 whether he was worried that Mr. Obama's speech at the U.N. General Assembly calling for a world without nuclear weapons would apply to Israel. Netanyahu had a problem with that. Well, no, he's not talking about us. We don't live in the world. God damn it. We don't care. No, not us. The Israeli leader told Channel 2, quote, it was utterly clear from the context of the speech that he was speaking about North Korea and Iran. A world without nuclear weapons. Well, that means North Korea and Iran to Netanyahu. Yeah, okay. It goes on, quote, but I want to remind you, this is Netanyahu speaking to Channel 2, that in my first meeting with President Obama in Washington, I received from him, and I asked to receive from him, an itemized list of the strategic understandings that have existed for many years between Israel and the United States on that issue. It was not for naught that I requested, and it was not for naught that I received that document. End quote. Really? Now, what they're talking about is an understanding that was reached at a summit between President Nixon and Israeli Prime Minister Golda Meir, back on September 25th, 1969. Avner Cohen, author of Israel and the Bomb, and the leading authority outside the Israeli government on the history of Israel's nuclear program, said the accord amounts to, quote, the United States passively accepting Israel's nuclear weapon status as long as Israel does not unveil publicly its capability or test a weapon, end quote. Well, we know that the Israel tested weapons. Israel tested nuclear weapons off the coast of South Africa back in the 80s during the apartheid government there under an agreement between Botha and the Israeli government. Money changed hands, nods were nodded, winks were exchanged, and Israel tested their nuclear weapons. You see how this goes on? The whole world knows this, except, apparently, us. We'll be back after the break. Just about 7 past the hour, final hour of the Molloy program from the beautiful state-of-the-art facilities of Green 960, our affiliate here in San Francisco. And again, thanks to everybody who has made the 3 days I've been here such a hoot. It's been a lot of fun. I do appreciate it. Are we web streaming a video now? Yeah! Oh, that's me over there. Oh, okay. If you want to go to Green 960's website, is that right? And they can just log on and watch the video? Or they have to do, oh, they haven't started streaming it yet? Oh. The button has to be clicked here? I'm talking with Robert, our producer tonight. And apparently they're... Oh, you got to come in and click a button here. Okay, Robert's going to click a button here. Bless his heart. Where were we before the break? Oh, that's right, about this article in the Washington Times... that Barack Obama has agreed to keep Israel's nuclear weapons a big secret, which is just craziness to me. But anyway, back to the Washington Times. They say there's no formal record of this agreement that's been going on for 40 years, nor have the Israeli nor American governments ever publicly acknowledged that such agreement exists. In 2007, however, the Nixon Library declassified a July 19, 1969 memo from National Security Advisor Henry Kissinger, who's also a war criminal. I added that part. That's not in the Times. That comes closest to articulating U.S. policy on this issue. The memo says, quote, this is Kissinger,
while we might ideally like to halt actual Israeli possession, what we really want at the minimum may be just to keep Israeli possession from becoming an established international fact.
Now, what does that translate to? I digress from the Washington Times article. Very simply, it just means Kissinger saying, let's all lie. Let's agree to lie to the international community. Let's lie where it concerns nuclear nonproliferation treaties. Let's lie about all of this so that Israel can have their nukes. Why? I don't get this. Is it the element of surprise? The Israelis always wanted the Arab countries to be wondering, and if they were wondering, they might not attack? But that's nonsense. If you don't know the truth, there's a 50-50 chance either way, right? So why didn't Israel come out and say, yes, goddammit, we have all kinds of nukes! And if you Arab bastards attack us, we will glass your country! Why didn't they do that? Well, what's with this? Yes, we do. No, we don't. Yes, we do. No, we don't. You'll never know. What is that? What kind of schizophrenic policy is that? But I digress. Avner Cohen, the author of Israel and the Bomb, says that this kind of a policy was the equivalent of don't ask, don't tell. Oh, now that's cute. So anyway, according to the Washington Times, the Netanyahu government has sought to reaffirm the understanding in part out of concern that Iran would seek Israeli disclosure of its nuclear program in negotiations with the U.S. and other world powers. Iran has frequently accused the U.S. of having a double standard. No, really? By not objecting to Israel's arsenal. Oh, there's that Ahmadinejad again. There he goes again with his nonsense. U.S. has a double standard. Oh, God. Mr. Cohen said the reaffirmation and the fact that Mr. Netanyahu sought and received a written record of the deal suggests that, quote, it appears not only that there was no point of understanding of what had been agreed to in September 1969, but it's also apparent that even the notes of the two leaders may no longer exist. It means that Netanyahu wanted to have something in writing that implies that understanding. It also affirms the view that the United States is, in fact, a partner in Israel's policy of nuclear opacity. Oh, don't you love that? Nuclear, it's opaque. You can't, Only if you're a dumbass, right? Only if you agree to be an ignorant dumbass. Well, I don't know nothing. I see nothing. I know nothing. Come on. Jonathan Pellet, a spokesman for the Israeli Embassy in Washington, declined to comment, as did the White House National Security Council. Well, of course. So, you know, Israel stays outside of any agreement that concerns the restricting of nuclear weapons. Meanwhile, everybody in the Arab world and everybody in the Persian world, which would be Iran, understands, of course Israel has nukes. What are you talking about? So any other country that feels threatened by Israel, Israel constantly says, well, we're threatened. They want to push us into the sea. I think there probably are some crazy people that are not Israelis in the Middle East who still believe that nonsense, because it's never going to happen. Everyone knows that. But everyone also knows that Israel is a nuclear power, which really does nothing except point out the utter and absolute and complete and total acid-etched hypocrisy of the United States when we talk about restricting Iran or any other country in the Middle East from having nuclear weapons. We want a nuclear-free zone. Oh, you do? Well, then what are you going to do about the several hundred nuclear weapons that Iran, that Israel has?
We don't talk about that.
Why not?
We don't talk about that.
Why not? You see how this goes? I'm totally anti-nuke. Any country. I think the United States. I think Russia. I think every country ought to, I don't know what. What do we do with them? How do you get rid of them? You put them on a gigantic rocket and send them into outer space? I don't know. I'm against every country having nuclear bombs, including Israel. How about that? And Iran. All of them. But you know, Obama talks about nuclear nonproliferation. Obama talks about, like every American president has, oh, well, we want to get rid of nuclear weapons because they're just awful. They're just awful. They're terrible, terrible. And yet, that's a lie. That's a lie. And it's a lie that every American president since Truman, since Nixon, has uttered. We don't want to get rid of nuclear weapons. Are you kidding me? So, just thought I would delve into the madness of the Washington Times to share that with you, because I'm sure the story is probably true. Why would Barack Obama be any different where it concerns policy, U.S. policy regarding Israel? There is no reason. There's not one reason. But that just makes his job all the more difficult. If his job is to seek a peace agreement between the Israelis and the Palestinians, it makes his job all the more difficult if he seeks to convince the Iranians not to do this, not to develop nuclear weapons. And meanwhile, Iran is saying, you know, behind the scenes, screw you. What are you talking about? Why don't you go to your buddies in Tel Aviv and tell them that? You know, which country right now lives under a constant stream of threats from the United States and Israel?
Yeah,
that's right. Iran. So who's to blame them? in their paranoia. And that's, isn't that the only reason people develop nuclear weapons? Is because they're just, they're paranoid, they're scared of their own shadow, and they think that developing weapons of mass destruction is somehow going to protect them? When any fool beyond the eighth grade now should know, well, I don't know about eighth grade now, but anybody should know that you don't start a nuclear war. Because if you do, then the whole goddamn show comes to an end. All of it. Everything. It's over. And that was a policy under which we operated for 50 years with the Soviet Union. Mutual assured destruction. Read Jonathan Schell's The Fate of the Earth. It still applies. Nuclear winter. Death of everything. Last time I brought up Schell's book, I had some idiot write to me and say,
well, Mike, that's, you know, wouldn't necessarily be nuclear winter, you know.
Oh, okay, yeah. So I'm against any country having nuclear weapons. Against all countries having nuclear weapons. But, you know, this blatant hypocrisy and ridiculous secrecy,
well, we're not going to tell you if we have any.
What?
Yeah, we're opaque.
You're opaque.
Yeah, but the Iranians can't have them.
And why not?
Because they might attack us.
But you're threatening to attack them.
Oh, well, that's just rhetoric.
It's just, it's absolute madness, isn't it? In Arlington says, Mike, what's your thoughts on the theory that the real reason we are in Iraq and Afghanistan is to create a classic military two-front war before we invade Iran? That's the real reason we will put 40,000 additional troops in Afghanistan. Warren from Arlington. I guess in classic military strategy, yeah, that would be the thing, that would be a reason. I don't know what to believe anymore. I don't know. If I just know that apparently Barack Obama and McChrystal, the general who now controls everything, and apparently has great influence on U.S. Foreign policy, they held an unannounced meeting in Copenhagen on Friday, which, regardless of what these mouth-breathing weirdos in right-wing radio, now that's not a mention, like I said, I wasn't going to do anymore. That's just commenting on the discussion. You know, that's the reason, don't you folks get it? That's the reason Obama went to Copenhagen. It has nothing to do with this goddamn Olympic nonsense. And it is nonsense. Come on, come on. The Olympics, it's just another corporate, global corporate enterprise. And the athletes that participate, in so many instances, are either hiding their real gender or junked up on drugs that have enhanced their capabilities. Come on, you know it's in the tank. But I digress again. So, you know, this idea that Obama went there, Barack Obama, Michelle Obama was already there making the case, and that, oh yeah, the President of the United States is going to go to Copenhagen strictly to pitch the Chicago as bring the Olympics. That is so ridiculously, I mean, the whole concept is so asinine that it could only come out of the mouths of right-wing pundits. What he was there for was to meet, as the New York Times points out, with Stanley McChrystal, his Afghanistan commander. McChrystal was in London, flew to Copenhagen. Obama was in D.C., flew to Copenhagen. You know, why did they meet there? Because if Obama would have said, General McChrystal, come on, we're going to have a meeting in the Oval Office. Oh, my God! It's Truman and MacArthur all over again. So they met to talk about, in Copenhagen, to talk about Obama's war plans. So, you know, the question here, is it a matter of a two-front war that Warren is emailing in about? Classic military strategy. I don't know, Warren. I have no idea. I have no idea. I took several courses in political science, in international relations, and spent two semesters studying military alliances. And anything that is done ever since, well, certainly Bush Jr. and now Obama, defies explanation. Where it to me, I'm not an expert. I took the courses. I understand some of this stuff. But international relations that lays out the theories of how this stuff works, how you ply one nation against the other, how you build alliances, how the alliances have to be dissolved if certain things happen, tipping points, actions taken, whether they are covert or overt, whether it's a non-state actor or a state actor who takes the action. All this stuff is really fascinating stuff, and I really enjoyed it. If I would have had more money, I would have stayed in school, but I couldn't, you know. So, okay. But in studying the bit that I did for a couple of semesters, you know, I kind of got it in my head, okay, well, this is how this stuff works. This is very interesting. And anything I've seen since, up to and including, or going back to and including our invasion and occupation of Vietnam, makes no sense. It just makes no sense at all. So you're left with a very clear understanding that the wars we've been involved in have nothing to do with U.S. national security, have nothing to do with alliances, have nothing to do with the betterment of the American people, and everything to do with the corporatists who demand the wars. Now, there are other periods in our history. Spanish-American War was another example of that. But you read this, you know, and you read the ancient the ancients who devised alliances, the ancient Greeks, the Romans not so much, but the ancient Greeks, the Chinese, the theories on the so-called art of war and all this stuff, you know, and Machiavelli. You read all this stuff and you think, well, okay, there is a coherency to this war crime that's called war, this crime against humanity that's called war. And then you see what, or alliances, or international relations, and then you see what U.S. governments continue to do, and you say, well, Jesus, I guess there isn't. About 26 before the hour. Okay, back to some phone calls here. Douglas is in Sacramento. Hey, Douglas.
Hey, Mike.
How are you?
I made it home safely.
Oh, good.
It was a good gig.
At Yoshi's, yeah, that was a lot of fun, yeah.
Yeah, I wanted to give a shout-out to Yoshi's and the Green 960 for doing that. That was really nice.
Yeah, it was.
I've got a couple of optimistic things to say for a change.
Okay.
Have you ever heard of the VEER program?
The what? You got to turn your radio down. Will you do that for me, or your computer?
Oh, 1 second.
Okay. Do 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 do.
Okay, I'm back.
Oh, good, good.
I had it down low enough.
Yeah. Okay. Now, what? Do I know what?
The VEER program. It's pronounced VEER. I think it's spelled. It's spelled W-I-R.
No,
it started in Switzerland in 1934.
No, I have no idea what it is.
Okay. It's an example of a local exchange traded system. It's like a co-op currency.
Yeah.
Like I said, it's been going fine for the Swiss for like 70, 80 years.
Uh-huh.
And what you said about the right-wing radio and such, I think this it applies to this too. The money people don't have all the power they think they do either, because there are lots of people out there doing things, setting up exchanges like this and mm-hmm. doing business and getting along fine, and nobody in this country seems to have heard anything about it.
Well, I think those plans are fine if you're going to deal with a very local economy. You can't use that sort of system globally. It can be done.
Well, globalization hasn't done much for us.
Well, no, of course it hasn't. But I'm saying, globalization is hog snot. But having forms of exchange money that are recognized globally is an absolute necessity. You don't have to. I mean, as long as you're going to have international trade, if you'd want to have international trade, let's forget globalization. Let's pretend like everything was back normal. And, we make things and sell them overseas. They make things and sell them over here. And everybody exchanges their money and exchanges their products and everyone's happy. You can't do that if you're dealing with local scrip. It just can't be done. So I'm glad it works. I'm glad it works for the Swiss.
Anyway, check this out. It's in a magazine called Ode. O-D-E.
Yeah.
I'm looking at this in the December 2008 issue. And they've got a website, www.odemagazine.com.
Yeah.
It's a neat magazine. Might enjoy looking
okay.
at it.
Okay. All right. I'll do it. Douglas, thank you. I appreciate you checking in, pal. I really do. John is in Los Angeles. Hey, John.
Hey. Thanks for telling us about Obama's trip to Copenhagen.
That's, I don't know that to be absolute truth, but it sure makes sense to me. He's not going to go over there and play grab ass with the IOC and trying to sell Chicago. That's just not going to happen. It seems to me anyone with a more than a fourth grade education would understand that. He's not going over there to do that. He's going over there to meet with McChrystal.
Yeah. Well, either way, it would have been rather corporatist and possibly fascist end game to his trip, because the whole policy of this country is fascist. You may think it's crazy, but if Barack Obama is just, completing the policy, then he's also taking part in the fascism. It's just a mini-me to the United States. It's fascist. I'll just give one of your sighs.
Okay. All right, John. Thank you.
Thanks.
Yeah, I appreciate it. I understand what you're saying. I really do. I do. It's frustrating to try to articulate it. It's frustrating for me every night. Tony in Maine writes, Mike, I'm not sure if you touched on the IOC's decision to have Rio host the 2012 Olympics. I think it's 2016. Actually, the 2016 Olympics. But I had a few thoughts on the subject. Tony writes, first of all, I think the IOC made the right decision to award the city of Rio de Janeiro with the Summer Games. South America is yet to host a Summer Game, so I'm happy with their choice. Well, what gets me is the criticism President Obama has been getting for Chicago not getting the Games. They, and I'm sure you know who they are saying he failed. His trip to Copenhagen was a waste of time. Yet, what was he supposed to do? He was in a lose-lose situation. Had he done nothing, he would have been criticized for not trying to get his home city a chance at getting the Olympics. And now he's being bashed for trying in a lost cause. But realistically, Chicago probably had no shot of winning. The finalists, Madrid, Tokyo, and Rio, are far more attractive choices than Chicago, and that's not to say Chicago isn't a great city. But the thing that really irks me was the talk from the right-wing nut jobs who were lobbying for this choice to fail. They derided the city of Chicago. They pointed to the corruption of Illinois politics. And once again, they hoped and prayed that Obama would fail. And again, we are seeing these so-called patriotic Americans' true colors shine. I've seen illegal immigrants who are more patriotic than these people. Thoughts? Well, I pretty much laid it out. I don't think he went there to give a pitch for Chicago, which is not his hometown anyway. I don't think that's why he was there. I really don't. I think he was there because Stanley McChrystal could get there, and they had to discuss the bloody policies of Afghanistan that are coming. Boy, I'd like to think I'm wrong, but I just about can guarantee you that when Obama finally makes his decision, it's going to be more troops, more soldiers, more death, more destruction, more waste of time and blood and energy and money and just going into this sinkhole that is Afghanistan. What a shame, huh? What a damn shame. Bill is in Cleveland. Hey, Bill, welcome to the program.
Good evening, Mike. How are you?
I'm okay. How are you?
Civil rights man in Cleveland, Ohio, home of the stolen election of 2004.
Yeah, I hear that.
Yeah, it's been downhill ever since.
Yeah.
Maybe actually ever since 2000, but I digress. You know, I think that the entire anti-war movement and basically the left is suffering from, more than anything, just a little bit of malaise.
Yeah.
That we have no leadership. Grayson, boy, bless his heart. You know,
yeah, the congressman from
down,
Florida.
Man.
Yeah,
he's,
right.
He's a guy out there, and obviously Dennis and so forth. But, you know, it really irks me, the part you talked about with the how the left-wing noise machine really doesn't get any traction with the electorate.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, look at who voted for who, you know, in the last election. And I would recommend to all the crazy, you know, knuckle-dragger conservatives, so-called conservatives that listen to this show, that they should check out some books, and if they can read. And right on top of my list, and by the way, thanks for reading the Quigley thing from the G20. That was fantastic.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that was great. But, you know, obviously, you know, the House of Saud, House of Bush, and our madhouse are two that just come right off the top of my head. But I think what really, like, shaped my outlook on our world as we see it today is John Perkins' Confessions of an Economic Hitman.
Economic Hitman, yeah, which I have not read, but I have heard report after report after report that's a real eye-opener, and if you really want to know what's going on, read that.
Yeah, and he's got a follow-up book that just came out maybe 9 months ago or something. Naomi Klein, obviously, Shock Doctrine.
Right.
You have to read that.
Yeah.
But I think the big thing is Chalmers Johnson's trilogy with Blowback, Sorrow of Empire, and the last book, Nemesis. And in the preface of Nemesis, he describes Nemesis as the goddess of retribution,
yeah,
and vengeance, the punisher of pride and hubris, waits impatiently with us. And in that book, he describes how no other country can match the weaponry and power of the imperialistic American military. And the only thing that they have to hold on to is our economic squeeze. And now what we're seeing is that the other countries, the European Union and so forth, are saying now, hey, wait a minute, maybe the United States dollar isn't such a good bet. And here's what really scares me, is that I read that Iran is now setting up a new oil
bourse
trading in, guess what? Euros.
Right. Well, that.
Guess what took down Saddam Hussein?
Same thing.
Bingo. A week before we invaded, that's exactly what he did.
Well, again, Bill, and thanks, Bill. I don't make any claim to understand any of this. It's there are no formulas being followed. no historical precedents that make any sense are being applied. No strategies that equal mutual peace or understanding are being applied. Nothing. You know, somebody or some group of somebodies, I would assume it's just corporate America that doesn't give a tinker's damn about human life or their own lives, are just making this stuff up on the fly. I wish I understood more. But I don't, and I don't think I will. We'll be right back. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. For the hour. Thanks to the crew, everybody here at Green 960 in San Francisco for providing the facilities to do our program the last two nights and the gig on Wednesday night, which was a lot of fun. Also to Ben Birch, our technical advisor, Bruce Enberg, Kay Petrini, Bob Alexander, Bridget Wolf, who else? Kathy Bay, the executive producer. Who am I leaving out? Sharon Gordy, our military affairs correspondent. I think that's everybody. The executive producer and engineer of the program, Kathy Bay, not tonight. Got an email from her. She's home baking bread. Oh, my God. Oh, I can't wait. Baking bread. Got an email here from Kate. I'm not going to share the whole thing with you, but she's camped tonight in a Walmart parking lot. By choice, she writes, the Walmart parking lot has usual victims of the economy this month, those who are living in their cars and pickups, even one who has a little bitty trailer parked out at the edge of the lot. Most of these folks work at some job but can't afford housing. Happily, there's no one here with children. They're parked somewhere else. Winter is setting in here in Montana. Whatever will happen to them then? I feel like an outsider because I'm here by choice. I have a laptop, Sirius radio, cash, just passing through. And et cetera, et cetera. There's some more in the email here. Signed, Kate. Yeah, Walmart allows people to do that, apparently. You can park there if you're homeless. I am really, 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 really worried. I'm worried about the economy. I'm worried about our military policies overseas. I remember during the late 70s and 80s, all through the Reagan years, when things were really bad. I didn't pay too much attention to it back then. I had just started working at CNN. It just kind of blew right past me, and I was just kind of oblivious. I was a single parent then. I had had a young son who was about 6, 7, 8 years old. But we got through. You know, I mean, we just did our thing. And it didn't really hit us, Chris and me, economically. We just kind of cruised. You know, I asked him the other day, I said, when you were a kid growing up, did you ever think we were poor? And he said, no. Hell no. What are you talking about? I said, oh, well, I'm glad you feel that way. If you only would have known. But this time, I just can't seem to get the anxiety out. Can you? I mean, All right, we do talk radio. This is, you know, it's not really all that important. It's just where people get together at this program anyway and talk about stuff. I've got no solutions. I don't think you do either. I very seldom have guests. You know, why bring in the experts? It's really kind of irrelevant. If there's something really important out there, I'll just print it off and share it with you. But so, you know, the point of this program pretty much is just like I've said before. It's the end of the day. Gather around the campfire and talk about, oh my, oh my, oh my. And sometimes it can be a little bit funny, and sometimes it's not so funny, and sometimes we tell stories and do things, and you know what this program's about. But I can't seem to shake this really deep, and it's going deeper. It's like, you know, it's not skin deep, it's not muscle deep, it's bone deep. You know, this bone deep concern. But holy God, this is not turning around. It is not, you know, then the numbers come out like they came out today. Unemployment is up. Jobless claims up. More jobs gone. People getting desperate. I hate to do the, and winter is setting in. But it's true. Winter is setting in. What the hell are people going to do this winter? What are people going to do who are just holding on right now when those heating bills hit? And a friend of mine who is in the mortgage recovery business, he's in reverse mortgages is what he does, which is such a good idea. But, you know, he's telling me that all hell is going to break loose because a lot of these interest-only mortgages that were 5, 7, and 9 year mortgages that were set back, you know, 5, 7, 9 years ago that are now coming due. And these mortgages where people only paid interest, and meanwhile the principal kept going up, and now all of a sudden, you know, the $1,800 or $1,900 a month they were paying is now going to go to $4,000 a month. And what's going to happen? And his opinion is there's going to be another massive wave of bank foreclosures, more unemployment. I can't seem to get over this and just say, okay, look, we've gotten through worse situations in this country before. You know, our parents went through, our grandparents anyway, went through depression, went through two world wars, went through collapse of the stock market, went through, you know, they went through and they survived. Yeah, but things were a little bit different back then. The United States was still, became of this manufacturing behemoth. There were unions. There was an emerging middle class that was able to make things better, right? With jobs and taking care of granny and sending the kids to college and maybe pooling money with people and buying a little place up at the lake where you could go in the summertime and fish and swim and hang out. You know, it just really has me kind of freaked. But here's Kevin. As long as Kevin Kenny is singing, I'm going straight to hell, just like my mama said, I guess everything's all right. I'll see you Monday back in Atlanta. Take care. Keep it lit, okay? I'm Mike Malloy. Have a great weekend, Kevin Kenny, wherever you are.